L'Officine Universelle Bully presents Ancient Beauty Rituals, Episode 6, Party at the Dark Tower. The promising young writer Zora Neale Hurston goes to a party at the Goddess of Joy's mansion, Harlem, 1927. Zora leaned back against the cushions and tilted her head to speak to her friend Gertie. "How was your evening at the Savoy?" she asked. "Can Fred dance?" Gertie nodded, grinning. "He's a real Oliver Twist. The bands were just ducky." Zora laughed and rolled her eyes. "You and your slang. Let's see, he's a great dancer and you like the music. Am I right?" She looked around the elegant reception room at the Walker Parlor, a chic salon on 136th Street. The space buzzed with women waiting for hair appointments, facials, and manicures. A glass case displayed Walker soaps, creams, and hair products with their signature yellow labels. Two clients were at the counter. They had clearly had their hair done and were paying for their services. One had a bob with side-to-side Marcel waves, and the other had longer hair that had been pressed straight, braided, and twisted into buns covering her ears. Her nails were quite shiny. She must have also had a manicure where they'd been polished with powder and a chamois buffer. Another woman walked up to the counter and requested the Walker Cleanser and Vanishing Cream Moisturizer, explaining that she'd just had a facial and wanted to try the products at home. Zora and Gertie were waiting for their own hair appointments at a round, velvet-upholstered settee at the centre of the room, from where Zora could hear several conversations. One woman sitting nearby was talking to her companion about registering women to vote, while another described the beaded dress she planned to wear to the party upstairs this Saturday. Zora knew that meant Alelia Walker's apartment, above the salon. Daughter of the legendary Madam C.J. Walker, Alelia was famous for her parties filled with artists, musicians, and writers, and was known as the Goddess of Joy. Listening to the chatty customer, Zora gleaned that Langston Hughes and Jesse Redman Fawcett were expected at the party. How exciting, since she would be attending as well. Madam C.J. Walker built an international beauty empire. Walker, born Sarah Breedlove in 1867 to parents who'd been enslaved, suffered from hair loss as a young woman. Many soaps used to wash hair contained lye, which aggravated scalps and led to infections and hair loss. Breedlove worked as a laundress, a cook, and sold hair care products for another black entrepreneur, Annie Turnbow Malone, before developing her own. Both lines included vegetable-based shampoos and salves that contained petrolatum and sulfur, which healed the scalp and encouraged hair to grow back. A marketing genius, Breedlove adopted the glamorous name Madam C.J. Walker and used photographs of herself in her advertisements. This was a breakthrough. She was challenging racist stereotypes used in advertising. Consumers now saw a real, attractive black woman on products aiming to address their needs. Walker and her former employer professionalized a career path for black women in the beauty industry. Malone opened the country's first cosmetology school, and Walker likewise trained women to be what she called beauty culturalists. Both hired thousands as sales agents who could make up to $3 to $5 a day, compared to the $2 a week many women earned as maids. And many agents went on to open their own salons. Walker's brand was an international phenomenon, and she became the first black millionaire in the US and a philanthropist supporting black schools and organizations. Walker and her daughter Alelia moved from Indianapolis to Harlem in 1916, where they bought a grand townhouse despite discriminatory real estate practices and established a beauty school and salon. Alelia invited black intellectuals and artists to parties in her home, creating a different sort of salon upstairs. Back at her rented room, Zora sat at her table, looking over her manuscript. She could hear a bus, people walking home from work, and children skipping rope on the sidewalk. Someone knocked at her door. It was her friend, Billy, a gregarious young sculptor who lived at a rooming house a few blocks away where young artists could stay for free. Billy was a reliable source of information about the art and literary scene. "I walked 5 blocks to tell you that the folks from Opportunity magazine will be at the party tonight," she said, out of breath. "I thought you'd like to know." "Come in. Thank you for thinking of me. Yes, since I won those literary prizes, they've been a real help. You know, they helped me get into Barnard so I could finish the degree I started at Howard." She opened her closet and took out a red dress. "I have an idea to make them laugh," said Zora. "I bought this because it made me think of Little Isis in Drenched in Light, my first story they published. Isis borrows her grandmother's new tablecloth to dance at a carnival. My blue velvet is dressier, but..." Billy played with the pom-pom trimming on the hem. "Definitely wear this. You'll be the berries. I'll run home, get this clay out from under my nails, and shine myself up. Good thing I remember to buy some new tooth powder. I'll see you at the Dark Tower. Come early, it'll be packed." '1920s fashions were a dramatic break with tradition. Instead of long dresses worn over curved corsets, by the mid-1920s, women's styles were shorter and straighter, still below the knees, but certainly shorter than previous eras. A loose, boyish silhouette was in vogue, so women with curves might wear an undergarment called a bandeau to flatten their breasts, or a longer corselet that created more of a tubular shape with straps for stockings. Men continued to wear suits with a variety of hats, but stylish young men coveted bulky coats made of raccoon fur. Daytime looks included dropped-waisted dresses and pleated skirts worn with long sweaters. Emerging designer Coco Chanel took knit jersey, previously reserved for undergarments, and made it stylish as sweaters, coats, and suits. Hats were worn low on the forehead, and by the end of the decade, many wore the face-framing cloche, which framed the face and flattered the new short hairstyles. As for shoes, pumps with T or ankle straps and cutouts, or lace-up Oxfords, had low, wide heels and were worn with either long stockings or knee socks. More women were playing sports and swimming, and sleeveless swimsuits were also a bold change from the previous decade. Magnificent evening dresses burst with details like embroidery, beads and paillettes, low backs, layers of chiffon, and asymmetrical or fringed hems. Fluid fabrics and light-catching elements made an impression on a dance floor. The most daring young women might roll down their stockings and add rouge on their knees to emphasize a flash of skin. Evening shoes sparkled with metallic finishes or rhinestone buckles, and the most luxurious evening coats were made of gloriously soft silk velvet. Jewellery was inspired by geometric Art Deco lines or the discovery of King Tutankhamun's tomb in 1921, which started a craze for Egyptian-inspired designs. Headbands called bandeaus might be worn in the evening instead of a hat. Short hairstyles left more room to show off long drop earrings, and it was also fashionable to wear strands of pearls or beads, perhaps with a tassel or tied in a knot. Light and jazz poured from the windows of the Walker home. Entering the house door, not the salon where she'd met Gertie the previous day, Zora went up the stairs. Thanking a young woman for taking her coat, Zora entered a room already full of guests. There were several sofas, a grand piano in the corner, rugs on the floor, and tall drapes at the window. Women's dresses sparkled, and men wore slim three-piece suits. Zora saw Alelia Walker holding court wearing a black dress with gold embroidery and dramatic flowing sleeves. Zora went to say hello. "Good evening, Miss Walker. I'm Zora Neale Hurston. Thank you for the invitation," said Zora. "Hello. Call me Alelia. I loved your story about that sparky little girl showing off at the carnival. She reminded me of myself as a little girl. And then you won not one, but four literary prizes," said Alelia. "Yes, I used to be just like Isis, swinging on the gate, imagining the wider world. So winning those prizes felt quite wonderful," replied Zora. Alelia smiled. "I heard you burst into the awards party, flung a scarf around your neck and shouted the name of your play. Now that's the cat's meow. What brought you to Harlem? New York is the centre of publishing, and isn't Harlem the centre of New York? I arrived with $1.50 and a suitcase of manuscripts. Thanks to Opportunity magazine, now I'm studying at Barnard." "How marvellous. You'll certainly find some people to talk to this evening. Now get yourself a drink." Zora moved through the crowd, admiring the dresses and decor, the scent of tobacco, illicit alcohol, and perfume. The music came from a Victrola gramophone in a tall wooden case, a crowd looking through a box of recordings and choosing what to play next. A man wearing a colourful vest laughed as he and his partner danced the Charleston, their legs swinging and their elbows at sharp angles. Another young woman sank into a chair as the song ended, a sparkling clip in her short hair. Zora caught the faint scent of lavender that she associated with Walker hair products and paused to notice the range of hairstyles on display. A few women looked like ancient sculptures, their hair piled up and held in place with ribbons. And some had short cuts with ringlets that moved as they danced. Many of the younger women wore bobs like her own, with a side part, pressed with a hot comb and Walker's glossine. She wondered how many women at the party had visited the salon downstairs. Zora took in the scene around her. She frequently wrote about people in towns like Eatonville, Florida, where she'd grown up. But this world was also asking to be put into stories. People were moving from the rural South to cities for industrial jobs and hopefully less segregation and violence. Would they find what they wanted? What kind of lives would they build? Her thoughts were interrupted by a cry of, "But Garvey supported our businesses," from a circle of young men and women. A quieter group was debating the effectiveness of posters the NAACP had put up around town several years ago, asking people to boycott the film Birth of a Nation because it promoted racist stereotypes and the Klan. One of the men discussing the posters turned, and Zora recognized Langston Hughes. She'd met him when she was a student at Howard and had befriended him once she arrived in Harlem. He winked. "Welcome to the Dark Tower, Zora," he said. "I see you've met our joy goddess, Alelia. What are you working on these days?" Hughes had nicknamed the Walker House the Dark Tower. Universities were sometimes called the Ivory Tower, but it was here that the black intelligentsia of Harlem met to share ideas. Just like the fashions, hairstyles of the 1920s were dramatic and modern. Short hair was catching on, but full heads of long curls, sometimes held back with a scarf, were also in vogue. Women with longer hair might tuck it up so it looked like a shortcut, pile it on their head for a goddess look, or twist it into flat buns at their ears, a style jokingly called cootie catchers. Other women wore daring short cuts called bobs, worn either straight or curled, with and without bangs or a fringe. Kiss curls, shaped with pomade, curled on foreheads and cheeks. The shortest bobs, called Eton crops, were shaved in the back. These styles were worn by women from a range of economic groups and communities: Black, white, Asian, Latina. All influenced by a growing popular culture of movies and magazines. After fans learned that actress Clara Bow's short auburn curls were tinted with henna, the natural treatment became popular as women used it to colour their own hair. Actress Louise Brooks wore a dramatic helmet of smooth black hair and severe fringe. Billie Dove was known for her kiss curls, and Josephine Baker slicked down her Eton crop with her own brand of pomade called Baker Fix. Women who chose to cut their hair could take photos of their favourite stars to the barber for inspiration. As white women went to great efforts to curl their hair with new permanent wave machines and heated Marcel irons, many black women were straightening their hair. The Walker Hair System relied on gentle shampoo and healing scalp treatments, along with a pressing oil called Glossine, to add shine and protect hair when straightened using a hot comb. Both white and black women had used hot combs since the mid-19th century. But for black women, hair straightening was controversial. Many black men and women felt the fashionable pressed styles helped them claim beauty and dignity in a society that denied them so many rights, while others criticized the styles as following white beauty standards that refused to see tight curls as beautiful. Madam C.J. Walker skirted this debate by claiming she was a hair culturalist, specializing in hair care and growth. In one interview, she claimed, "I want the great masses of my people to take a greater pride in their personal appearance and to give their hair proper attention." There you are, Zora turned and saw Billy, resplendent in a green dress with scarab beetle brooches on each shoulder. An Egyptian-style headband held her bobbed curls. She was with an attractive man with a moustache and eyeglasses, and an older white woman wearing a mauve velvet dress. "Zora, I believe you're well acquainted with Charles Johnson and Annie Meyer. Why don't you talk about your latest novel, while I regale the delightful Mr. Hughes with a description of my latest sculpture before he reads his poems to everyone?" Charles Johnson was the editor of Opportunity, the magazine of the National Urban League. "Good evening, Zora," he said. "I believe your dress is a reference to our naughty friend and her infamous tablecloth." Zora laughed. "Yes, indeed. I thought it might amuse you." "It's lovely to see you, dear," said Annie Meyer. "Tell me, how are your classes?" She was a writer and activist who had found the financial support for Zora to attend Barnard. After finding some champagne, the three began a lively conversation about how it felt to be the first black student at Barnard and how she was portraying black country life and migration to cities in her stories and plays. Harlem in the 1920s was a centre of music and nightlife. Gramophones, early record players, were expensive, and people would go to theatres and dance halls to hear live music. The Savoy Ballroom, on 140th Street and Lenox Avenue, had two bandstands for non-stop music and a sprung dance floor that was replaced every 3 years because it wore out from constant use. Unlike the segregated Cotton Club, the management at the Savoy welcomed everybody as patrons or musicians, only caring whether you could dance or play swing jazz. Period films of professional dancers at the Savoy show women wearing short boots or low heels. All have short hair, and some flash shorts or knickers as they kick and spin. Makeup companies recognized that women might not carry a purse when they went out, and sold compacts disguised as shoe clips and powder puffs that could be held in a garter. Other spots included Harry Hanbury's Clam House, where Gladys Bentley performed in a tuxedo with backup singers in drag. Harlem also hosted some of New York's illegal speakeasies, which required membership cards for entry, and rent parties, where people charge small fees for entry to parties in their homes. African Americans frequently faced higher rents than white tenants while earning lower salaries, and parties helped close the gap. Fats Waller, a popular pianist and singer, would sometimes perform at house parties. Flaming my love for you, for you, for you, for you. The Great Depression hit Harlem hard, with one in four African Americans out of work by 1930. Black beauty shops continued to operate, but the Madam C.J. Walker Company and its competitors saw significant losses. Harlem remained a center of creativity and activism, but the romantic image of carefree dancers was not the reality for most people. Zora found Billy and Alelia chatting up guests next to a table offering grilled oysters, spiced ham, and deviled eggs. "Ah, the lovely Zora," exclaimed Alelia. She took a silver compact out of her tiny evening bag and inspected the kiss curls framing her face. "I see you've been dancing. Have you tried our supreme face powder? And don't forget to use some cleanser and vanishing cream this evening." Zora fanned her face and nodded, helping herself to some refreshments. Alelia continued, "Ladies, tell me, what do you think of lipstick? Mama never liked cosmetics. She thought they weren't respectable. But times are changing, wouldn't you say? Tell me, would you wear lipstick if our beauty culturalists found you the right shade?" "Yes, certainly," answered Zora, thinking about which of her new characters might wear lipstick. Just as she advocated for healthy hair, Madam C.J. Walker sold a line of skincare products, including witch hazel jelly and cold cream, and offered facials in her salons. While many companies marketed skin bleaches, such as a product called Lucky Brown Skin Lightener, both Malone and Walker refused to create such products. Instead, they claimed that attractive, healthy skin supported racial pride. Product lines marketed to white women likewise focused on skincare. Black and white women would apply cold cream to hydrate and powder to smooth their complexions. The more revealing fashions increased interest in skincare, creating a new market for moisturizing creams for the arms and back. Several fragrances still available today were launched during the 1920s, including Chanel No. 5, Coty Lemon, and Guerlain Shalimar. Beau and other actresses appeared in cosmetic and fragrance advertisements. Cosmetics had been associated with prostitutes for decades and denounced as artificial and dangerous. In fact, many products contained chemicals such as lead, which caused skin damage and health problems. But as actresses and singers wore dramatic makeup in order to be visible on flickering black and white film, makeup became more acceptable. Performers such as Josephine Baker and Clara Bow wore heavy eye makeup, dramatic lipstick, and plucked and redrew narrow eyebrows. During the daytime, women began to wear lipstick, rouge, and face powders in a range of subtle colours. While it was considered vulgar to apply lipstick to the entire mouth, women made what they called a Cupid's bow, applying lipstick at the center of their lips in the shape of a tiny heart. For an evening out, women might add eyebrow pencil and eyeliner, again influenced by the craze for all things Egyptian. For even more emphasis on the eyes, they might use the newly invented eyelash curler, or apply eyelash beautifier, which came in a little cake or pot with a miniature straight brush. It became acceptable to touch up makeup in public, and compacts with powder and sometimes an attached lipstick could be matched to evening outfits. Once I lived a life of a millionaire. Bessie Smith sang from the gramophone, and the last partygoers were beginning to leave. Charles Johnson put Zora's coat on her shoulders as he saw her and Billy to the door. "Don't forget to send me your latest manuscripts when you're ready," he reminded her. Zora promised to do so and headed down the block, arm in arm with her friend, her head full of the sights, sounds, and conversations of the evening.
Nobody wants me round that door. Without a doubt, no man can use you when you're down and out. I mean, when you're down and out.
This was an episode of Beauty Rituals Through the Centuries from Officine Universelle Bully. You will soon find a new story that will take you on a journey through time. Our podcasts are available on all listening platforms.